History always repeats itself, and mistakes are never learned. As historians, we strive to tell the truth of the past so the future can be better and learned. This week, at the time of this recording of this podcast, on the 24th of February 2022, President Putin and Russia have illegally invaded Ukraine under a false pretense of Western provocation. The History of Scotland podcast stands together with its Ukrainian listeners, to which there are many, against this unprovoked and cold-blooded attack from something that should belong and stay in our history books. I will be posting a donation link at the bottom of this episode in the description that will go straight to the affected families of soldiers of Ukraine, where you can support them further. This should never happen, and it should not be happening in today's world. Freedom for Ukraine. Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Scotland, episode 11, 10th Century Tour, part 2. In today's episode, we are going to be going on our grand tour, part 2, in and around Scotland in the 950s AD. Last week, we touched on Britain and discussed the kingdoms in Britain in the mid-10th century, around Indulf and then Duff McMalcolm's reign, which we discussed both reigns two episodes ago, ending with Culain coming to the throne. This episode and last week's episode should give you an understanding of the politics of the main nations around this time, as these countries will continue to grow and change as time passes and alliances will begin to form as we enter the Middle Ages that we know of today. As last week's episode, this is going to be a long one, another long episode. This week we are going to be touching on Scandinavia and the Vikings in Britain, the European kingdoms, and finally discussing the Pope and Christianity in and around Scotland. So sit back, relax, as we go on the grand tour of Europe in the 950s AD. The Vikings who invaded Western and Eastern Europe were mainly pagans from the same area as present-day Denmark, Norway and Sweden. Their Northern Germanic language, Old Norse, became the mother tongue of present-day Scandinavian languages. By 801, a strong central authority appears to have been established in Jutland, and the Danes were beginning to look beyond their own territory for land, trade and plunder. In Norway, the mountainous terrain and fjords formed a strong natural boundaries. Communities remained independent of each other, unlike the situation in lowland Denmark. By 800, some 30 small kingdoms existed in Norway. The sea was the easiest way of communication between the Norwegian kingdoms and the outside world. In the 8th century, Scandinavians began to build ships of war and send them on raiding expeditions, which started the Viking Age. The North Sea rovers were traders, colonisers, explorers and plunderers. In England, the Viking attack on the 8th of June 793 AD that destroyed the abbey in Lindisfarne, a centre of learning on an island off the north coast of England in Northumbria, is regarded as the beginning of the Viking Age. Judith Jesk has argued that the start of the Viking Age can be pushed back to 700-750 AD, as it was unlikely that the Lindisfarne attack was the first attack, given archaeology evidence that suggests contacts between Scandinavian and British Isles earlier in the century. The earliest raids were more likely in smaller scale, but expanded in scale during the 9th century. In the supposed Lindisfarne attack, monks were killed in the abbey, thrown into the sea to drown, or carried away as slaves, along with the church's treasures, giving rise to the traditional but unattested prayer, "Free us from the fury of the Northmen, Lord." According to the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles, which we are referencing throughout today's episode, Viking raiders struck England in 793 AD and raided Lindisfarne, the monastery that held St. Cuthbert's relics, killing the monks and capturing the valuables. The raid marked the beginning of the Viking Age of invasion. Great but sporadic violence continued on England's northern and eastern shores, with raids continuing on a small scale across coastal England. While the initial raiding groups were small, a great amount of planning is to believe to have been involved. The Viking raids during the winter of 840 and 841 AD rather than the usual summer, having waited on an island off Ireland. In 850 AD, the Vikings overwintered for the first time in England, on the island of Funt in Kent. In 854 AD, a raiding party overwintered a second time at the Isle of Sheppey in the Thames estuary. In 864 AD, they reverted to Funet for their winter encampment. The following year, as we know, the Great Heaven Army, led by the brothers of Ivar the Boneless, Halfdan and Uber, and also by another Viking, Guthrum, arrived in East Anglia. They proceeded to cross England into Northumbria and captured York, establishing a Viking community in Jorvik, where some settled as farmers and craftsmen. Most of the English kingdoms, being in turmoil, could not stand against the Vikings. In 867 AD, Northumbria became the northern kingdom of the Coenslaeg Danelaw, after its conquest by the Ragnarsson brothers, who installed an Englishman, Egbert, as a puppet king. By 870 AD, the Great Summer Army arrived in England, led by a Viking leader called Bagsec and his five earls. Aided by the Great Heaven Army, which had already overrun much of England from its base in Jorvik, Bagsec's forces and Halfdan's forces, through an alliance, the combined Viking forces raided much of England until 871 AD. When they planned an invasion of Wessex on the 8th of January 871, Bagsec was killed at the Battle of Ashdown, along with his earls, as we discussed in last week's episode in the History of England. As a result, many of the Vikings returned to northern England, where Jorvik had become the centre of the Viking kingdom, but Alfred of Wessex managed to keep them out of his country. Alfred and his successors continued to drive back the Viking frontier and take York. A new wave of Vikings appeared in England in 947 AD when Eric Bloodaxe captured York. The Northern Isles, known to be the Norse word for Norjar, are the closest parts of Scotland to Norway, and these islands experienced the first and most long-lasting Norse influence of any part of Scotland. Shetland is some 300 kilometres due west of Norway, and its favourable conditions could be reached in 24 hours from Hordland in a Viking longship. Orkney is 80 kilometres further to the southwest. Some 16 kilometres due south of Orkney is the Scottish mainland. The two most northerly provinces of mainland Scotland, Caverness and Sutherland, fell under Norse control at an early date. South of there, the entire western seaboard of mainland Scotland, from Westeros to Kintyre, was also subject to significant Scandinavian influence. Throughout the Viking period, and much earlier than that, documentation is very scarce. Contemporary documentation of the Viking period of Scottish history is also very weak. The presence of the monastery of Ona led to this part of Scotland being relatively well recorded from the mid-6th century to the mid-9th century, but from 849 AD onwards, when Columba's relics were removed in the face of a Viking incursion, written evidence from local sources all but vanishes for 300 years. Given what is known about the frequency of sea transport around Orkney in the 7th century, it is highly likely that the Gaelic and Pictish sailors were aware of Scandinavia before the commencement of the Viking Age. It has also been suggested that an assault by forces from Fortiu in 681 AD, in which Orkney was annihilated, may have led to a weakening of local power base and helped the Norse come to prominence in this area. Scholarly interpretations of the period have led to widely divergent reconstructions of the Viking Age in Scotland. The traditional explanation is the Earldom Hypothesis. This assumes a period of Norse expansion into the Northern Isles and creation of an aristocratic dynasty that lasted well into the medieval period, which exerted considerable influence in Western Scotland and the Man into the 11th century. This version of events is essentially as told by the Norse sagas and is supported by some archaeological evidence, although it has been criticised for exaggerating the Orkneyan influence in the area. Norse contacts with Scotland certainly predate the first written records in the 8th century, although their nature and frequency are unknown. Excavations at Norwich on the island of Unst in Shetland indicate that the Scandinavian settlers had reached there perhaps as early as the mid-7th century, consistent with the dates produced for Viking levels at Old Skatness. From 793 AD onwards, repeated raids by Vikings on the British Isles are recorded. All the islands of Britain were devastated in 794 AD, with Iona being sacked in 802 AD and 806. These attacks on Christian settlements in the islands of the West were not new. In the 6th century, Tyre was raided by Pictish forces. Tory Island was attacked in the early 7th century by a marine fleet, and Donan of Egg and his 52 companions were murdered by the Picts on Eigg in 617 AD, as we've told in a previous episode. Various named Viking leaders who were probably based in Scotland appear in the Irish annals. Sockville in 837 AD, Troges in 845 AD, and Hakon in 847 AD. The King of Fortu, Egon, and the King of Dalrita, Eyed Bonata, were among the dead in the first major defeat to the Vikings in 839 AD. Although early reference to the Norse presence in the Irish records is that there was a King of Viking Scotland whose heir, Fëanor, brought an army to Ireland in 848 AD. The early Viking threats may have speeded a long-term process of Gallicization of the Pictish kingdoms, which adopted a Gaelic language and customs. There was a merger of Gaelic and Pictish crowns, although historians continue to debate whether it was a Pictish takeover of Dalrita, as we discussed how the Kingdom of Alba was formed in episode 6, 7 and 8 of the History of Scotland. This obviously came around as Synod MacAlpin in 840s AD, who brought to the power the House of Alpin, who were the leaders of a combined Gaelic Pictish kingdom for almost two centuries. In 870 AD, Dumbarton was besieged by Aimlad Connaugh and Imar, the two kings of the Northmen, who returned to Dublin from Britain the following year with numerous captives. Dumbarton was the capital of the Kingdom of Strathclyde, and we actually went over this in our previous episode, so if you wish to learn more, head back to that episode. 3 years earlier, Vikings had seized Northumbria, forming the Kingdom of York, and subsequently conquered much of England except for a reduced Kingdom of Wessex. In 902 AD, the Norse suffered a serious reverse in Ireland, losing control of Dublin, and this seems to have intensified attacks on emerging Kingdom of Alba. A year later, Dunkeld was attacked and Imar, the grandson of Imar, was killed in battle with the forces of Constantine II in mainland Scotland. In the late 10th century, the battle was won by Alban forces over the Vikings, yet these events were setbacks for the Norse rather than a definitive moment. Of more significance were the defeats at Bannockburn in 937 AD and the Battle of Tara in 980 AD. We will touch more on Norway slash Denmark's relationship with the Kingdom of Alba and Scotland as we progress past the 950s AD, but obviously around this time is just before Culain is coming to the throne. This is kind of the state of things up to this date in Scotland in relation to the Vikings. If we now sail to the continent and to Europe itself, let's touch upon the two main giant kingdoms that were left in Charlemagne's wake, that is West and East Francia. In medieval history, West Francia, or the Kingdom of the West Franks, refers to the western part of the Frankish Empire established by Charlemagne. It represents the earliest stage of the Kingdom of France, lasting from about 840 AD until 987 AD. West Francia emerged from the partition of the Carolingian Empire in 843 AD under the Treaty of Verdun, following the death of Charlemagne's son, Louis the Pious. In the August of 843 AD, after 3 years of civil war following the death of Louis the Pious on the 20th of June, the Treaty of Verdun was signed by his three sons and heirs. The youngest, Charles the Bold, received Western Francia. Lothair the Emperor received Middle Francia, and Louis the German received East Francia. Since the death of King Pippin I of Aquitaine in December 838 AD, his son had been recognised by the Aquitaine nobility as King Pippin II of Aquitaine, although the succession had not been recognised by the Emperor. Charles the Bold was at war with Pippin II from the start of his reign in 840 AD, and the Treaty of Verdun ignored the claimant and assigned Aquitaine to Charles. Accordingly, in June 845 AD, after several military defeats, Charles signed the Treaty of Loire and recognised his nephew's rule. This agreement lasted until the 25th of March 848 AD, when the Aquitanian barons recognised Charles as their new king. Therefore, Charles's armies had the upper hand, and by 849 AD had secured most of Aquitaine. In May, Charles had crowned himself King of the Franks and Aquitanians in Orleans. Archbishop of the Sens officiated the coronation, which included the first instance of the royal unification in West Francia. The idea of atoning Charles may be owed to the Archbishop of Reims, who composed no less than four ordains described appropriate for a royal consecration. By 858 AD, the Treaty of Mersenne was also being signed in the western part of Lotharingia, and that was added to the Kingdom of West Francia as well. In 875 AD, Charles the Bold was crowned Emperor of Rome. After the death of Charles's grandson, Carloman II, on the 12th of December 884 AD, the West Frankish nobles elected his uncle, Charles the Fat, already king in East Francia and the Kingdom of Italy, as their king. He was probably crowned king in Gaul on the 25th of May 885 AD at Grand. His reign was the only time after the death of Louis the Pious that all of Francia would be reunited under one ruler. In his capacity as king of West Francia, he seems to have granted the royal title and perhaps the regalia to the semi-independent ruler of Brittany, Alain I. His handling of the Viking siege of Paris in 885 and 886 AD greatly reduced his prestige. In 887 AD, his nephew revolted and assumed the title as king of East Franks. Charles retired and soon died in 888 AD. In Aquitaine, Duke Ranulf may have had himself recognised as king, but only lived another 2 years. Although Aquitaine did not become a separate kingdom, it was largely outside the control of the West Frankish kings. Odo, Count of Paris, was then elected by the nobles as the new king of West Francia, and was crowned the next month. At this point, West Francia was composed of Neustria in the west and in the east by Francia proper, the region between Meuse and the Seine. After the 860s AD, the Lotharingian noble Robert the Strong became increasingly powerful as a count of Anjou, Touraine and Maine. Robert's brother Hugh, Abbot of St. Denis, was given control over Austria by Charles the Bold. Robert's son Odo was elected king, as we discussed, in 888 AD, but Odo's brother Robert I ruled between 922 and 923 AD and was followed by Rudolf from 923 to 936 AD. Hugh the Great, son of Robert I, was elevated to title Duke of the Franks by King Louis, although in 987 AD his son Hugh Capet, yes, that Hugh Capet, was elected king and the Capetian dynasty began. At this point they controlled very little beyond Ile-de France. Outside the old Frankish territories and in the south, local nobles were semi-independent after 887 AD, as duchies were created: Burgundy, Aquitaine, Brittany, Gascony, Normandy, Champagne, and the County of Flanders. The power of the kings continued to decline, together with their inability to resist the Vikings and to oppose the rise of the regional nobles, who were no longer appointed by the king but became hereditary local dukes. In 877 AD, Bosso of Provence, brother-in-law to Charles the Bold, crowned himself as the King of Burgundy and Provence. His son, Louis the Blind, was King of Provence from 890 AD and Emperor between 901 and 905 AD. Rudolf II of Burgundy established the Kingdom of Burgundy in 933 AD. The power began to decline. After the death of Louis the Child, Lotharingia switched allegiance to the King of West Francia, Charles the Simple. After 911 AD, the Duchy of Swabia extended westwards and added the lands of Alsuin. Baldwin II of Flanders became increasingly powerful after Odo's death in 898 AD, gaining Boulogne and Tournus from Charles. The territory over which the king exercised actual control shrank considerably and was reduced to the lands between Normandy and the River Loire. The royal court usually stayed in Reims or Lyon. Norsemen began settling in Normandy, and from 919 AD, Meuse invaded repeatedly. In the absence of strong royal power, invaders were engaged and defeated by local nobles like Richard of Burgundy and Robert of Dastoria, who defeated the Viking leader Rollo in 911 AD. Yes, that Rollo. The Norman threat was eventually ended, with the last Danegeld being paid in 924 and 926 AD. Both nobles became increasingly opposed to Charles, and in 922 AD they deposed him and elected Robert I as the new king. After Robert's death in 923, nobles elected Rudolf as king and kept Charles imprisoned until his death in 929 AD. After the rule of King Charles the Simple, local dukes began issuing their own currency. King Rudolf was supposed to be his brother Hugh the Black and son of Robert I, Hugh the Great. Dukes of Normandy refused to recognise Rudolf until 933 AD. The king also had to move with his army against the southern nobles to receive their homage and loyalty. After 925 AD, Rudolf was involved in a war against the rebellious Herbert II, who received support from the kings Henry the Fowler and Otto I of East Francia. His rebellion continued until his death in 943 AD. King Louis and the Duke Hugh the Great was married to the sisters of East Frankish King Otto I, who after the deaths of their husband managed the Carolingian and Reptilian rule together with their brother Bruno the Great, Archbishop of Cologne, as regent. After further victories by Herbert II, Louis was rescued only with the help of the large nobles and Otto I. In 942 AD, Louis gave up Lotharingia to Otto I. Succession conflict in Normandy led to a new war in which Louis was betrayed by Hugh the Great and captured by Danish Prince Harald, who eventually released him to the custody of Hugh, who freed the king only after receiving a town of Lyon as compensation. The 13-year-old Lothar of France inherited all the lands of his father in 954 AD, and this is around the time Coulainn was coming to the throne. Lothar managed to increase his power, but this was reversed with the coming of age of Hugh Capet, who began forming new alliances of nobles and eventually was elected as king in 987 AD. This would begin the House of Capet, who would rule France through the High Middle Ages and also deserves its own podcast. East Francia, or the Kingdom of East Franks, was a successor state of Charlemagne's empire, ruled by the dynasty until 911 AD. It was created again through the Treaty of Verdun in 843 AD. In 833, after 3 years of civil war, the Treaty of Verdun was signed by his three sons. In 911 AD, Saxon, Franconian, and Bavarian and Swabian nobles no longer followed the tradition of electing someone from the Carolingian dynasty as king to rule over them, and on the 10th of December 911 AD elected one of their own as their new king. Because Conrad I was one of the dukes, he found it very hard to establish his authority over them. Duke Henry of Saxony was in rebellion against Conrad until 915 AD, and the struggle against Arnulf, Duke of Bavaria, cost Conrad his life. On his deathbed, Conrad I chose Henry of Saxony as a most capable successor. The kingship changed from the Franks to the Saxons, who had suffered greatly during the conquest of Charlemagne. Henry, who was elected to kingship by only Saxons and Franconians at Fislar, had to subdue other dukes and concentrated on creating a state apparatus which was fully utilised by his son and successor, Otto I. By his death in July 936 AD, Henry had prevented the collapse of royal power as was happening in West Francia and left a much stronger kingdom to his successor, Otto I. After Otto I was crowned as emperor in Rome in 962 AD, the era as we know as the Holy Roman Empire began. Before the Middle Ages, most of the population of what is now in Scotland probably practiced a form of Celtic polytheism. Evidence of Christian symbols and the destruction of shrines of other religions suggests that Roman occupation brought Christianity to the north of Britannia. The Christianisation of Scotland was carried out by Irish Scots missionaries and, to a lesser extent, those from Rome and England. Richard Fletcher argued that motivations may have included the example of St. Patrick and a growing interest in evangelism. In the 6th century, missionaries from Ireland were operating on the British mainland. These include St. Neilan, St. Cadogan and St. Columba. The result of these missionaries, as we have also discussed in a previous episode, means the Picts became converted to Christianity at a much faster rate, although the exact period is inconclusive and unknown. Early church buildings may originally have been wooden, like excavated at Whithorn, but of those of which evidence survives from this era are basic masonry-built churches beginning on the west coast and islands and spreading south and east. Early chapels tended to have square-ending, converging walls, similar to the Irish chapels of this period. Medieval parish churches' architecture in Scotland was typically much less elaborate than in England, with many churches remaining simple oblongs without transepts and aisles, and often without towers. In the Highlands, they were often very simpler, many built of rubble masonry and sometimes indistinguishable from the outside from houses or farm buildings. If you wish to understand our history of Christianisation in Scotland, please head to our earlier episodes where we go into a bit more of detail about the full Christianisation of Scotland. Before we now jump back to the continent, on Christmas Day in 800 AD, the Roman Patriarch Leo III crowned Charles, the eldest son of Pippin the Short, as Holy Roman Emperor, in essence denying the status of the Byzantine Empress Irene reigning in Constantinople. This act caused a substantial diplomatic rift between the Franks and Constantinople, as well as between Rome and other patriarchs in the East. Though the rifts were settled to some degree and the church in Rome in theory remained united with Constantinople and the rest of the imperial church, this would ultimately end in the Great Schism. With Charlemagne's coronation, the papacy had acquired a new protectorate in the west. This freed the pontiffs to some degree from the power of the emperor in Constantinople, but also led to a schism because the emperors and patriarchs of Constantinople interpreted themselves as the true descendants of the Roman Empire, dating back to the beginnings of the church. Pope Nicholas I had refused to recognise Patriarch Photius I of Constantinople, who in turn had attacked the Pope as a heretic because he kept the Finlog in the creed, which referred to the Holy Spirit emanating from the God, the Father and the Son. The papacy was strengthened through this new alliance, which in the long term created a new problem for the popes when, in the Investor controversy, succeeding emperors sought to appoint bishops and even future popes. Charles followed with a policy of forcible conversion of all Frankish subjects to the Roman Church, specifically declaring loyalty to Rome as opposed to Constantinople. The strength of the Frankish armies helped repel further incursions of Muslim forces in Europe. Charles was seen in the West as having revived the Roman Empire and came to be known as Charles the Great, Charlemagne in French. The reunification of Europe led to the increasing prosperity and a slow re-emergence of culture and learning in Western Europe. Charlemagne's empire came to be called the Holy Roman Empire by its inhabitants. The church in Rome became a central defining symbol of this empire. The Carolingian Renaissance was a period of intellectual and cultural revival during the late 8th and 9th centuries, mostly during the reigns of Charlemagne and Louis the Pious. There was an increase of literature, art, architecture, sculptural studies. The period also saw the development of the Carolingian Miscall, the ancestry of modern lowercase script, and the standardisation of Latin, which had become varied and irregular. To address the problems of illiteracy among clerk and court scribes, Charlemagne founded schools and attracted most learned men from all of Europe to his court. By the 9th century, largely under the inspiration of the Emperor of Charlemagne, Benedict's rule became the basic guide for Western monasticism. In the 9th century, the Byzantine Emperor Michael III struggled to appoint a different patriarch of Constantinople, and Pope Nicholas I struggled to keep Inticus there. After Michael was murdered, Inigitus was reinstated as patriarch without challenge. After this, a council was summoned in Constantinople and was held with Inigitus as patriarch. Inigitus' death in 877 AD allowed Perfitus to become patriarch in 879 to 888 AD, and another council in Constantinople annulled the decision of the previous council. The West takes only the first as the true and legitimate council, and the East only takes a second, beginning what would become as known as a Great Schism. Around this time as well, Scandinavia, Moravia, Bulgaria and Rus will begin to receive Christian missionaries and begin to transform themselves into that way of religion. And thus ends our grand tour of Europe during the 950s AD. This should hopefully give you an idea of where the world of Europe and beyond is at the time of Cúlainn coming to the throne. As we can clearly see, we are now in the early medieval times, and we are gone of the days of old, of the old Roman structure and states, instead replaced by the countries we know of today. Each of these subjects we have now touched upon in our grand tour can be their own episode. So with that being a case, sorry for glossing over any or a lot of detail, and this was more of an overview to give you all an understanding of the greater world, just as the Kingdom of Alba was becoming recognised around Europe. Maybe we'll do another one of these in the 11th or 12th century, just to keep giving you an understanding of the greater European stage. As always, any corrections or issues with the podcast, please let me know at thehistoryofscotlandpodcast@gmail.com. Next week, we'll be heading down to the common folk of the Kingdom of Alba and experiencing a day in the life of a Pict in the 950s AD, seeing what was life like back then. After that episode, we will return to our story and carry on with our new King of Alba, Cúlainn. Please, as always, leave a review if you can, and our podcast is always available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, Amazon Music, and Google Podcasts. Other than that, have a great week, guys. Stay safe. Catch you all in the next episode, which should be airing around Thursday to Friday next week. Stay safe. Stay well. Peace.